Hello, hello. I'm Andrew Sweatman, and you're listening to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. Emphasis on the classic as we continue our series on classic film essentials. Think of this as a starter pack for classic movies. We're digging into six different films, taking a look at the films themselves and the filmmakers, along with some historical context, all made for the total beginner. So if you're a newbie to old Hollywood, you're in the right place. My guest for this series is the classic Hollywood expert and film writer, Rance Collins, and he's back again today for our look at the 1944 Billy Wilder film, Double Indemnity. Now, really quick, I usually give a little update at the top of the show for the Arkansas listeners about film events coming up here in the Natural State. As we are in the middle of a global health crisis because of the coronavirus, nearly all the events have been postponed or canceled. So instead, I'll say, stay inside, watch some movies, and sign up for the Arthouse Garage monthly email newsletter if you need some movie recommendations. Okay, back to the film at hand. Double Indemnity is a gritty crime story about an insurance salesman, played by Fred McMurray, who falls in love with a married woman, played by Barbara Stanwyck, and the two of them cook up a murder plot to collect life insurance money on her husband. It's very dark, it's very thrilling, it's pretty sexy, and it's incredibly well made. Rance and I do not spoil the ending of this film, so feel free to listen in whether you've seen it or not. And with that, here is our discussion of the 1944 classic, Double Indemnity.
I killed Dietrichson. Me, Walter Neff, insurance agent, 35 years old, unmarried, no visible scars. Until a while ago, that is. Yeah, I killed him. I killed him for money and for a woman. It all began last May. I was thinking about that dame upstairs and the way she had looked at me. And I wanted to see her again, close, without that silly staircase between us. How could I have known that murder can sometimes smell like honeysuckle?
I can't stand it anymore. What if they do hang me?
They're not going to hang you, baby.
It's better than going on this way.
They're not going to hang you. Because you're going to do it and I'm going to help you.
Welcome back once again, Rance Collins, to Arthouse Garage. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Doing quite well. Today we're discussing Double Indemnity, which is a great movie directed by Billy Wilder, and one that I'd actually wanted to watch for a long time. I've seen, I think, three other Billy Wilder movies and love each of them. One of them is The Apartment, which is one of my favorite movies ever. Honestly, it's in the top 10. I really, really love it. And then Sunset Boulevard I'd seen, as well as Some Like It Hot, the hilarious Marilyn Monroe comedy.
My God.
I saw that one in high school and was just like, oh my gosh, people were making jokes about this stuff in the 50s. it's a great movie if you haven't seen it. But this one, Double Indemnity, is pretty different than the rest of those, although there are some common threads I was able to kind of see a little bit, just kind of his work through the years. This one is earlier than all three of those others, I think. This one was 1944, so one of his early ones. And so a question I actually have for you. So this is a film noir, which actually... on a previous episode of Arthouse Garage, we kind of broke down what that is with another guest like a year ago. So listeners, go back and hear that. But basically, film noir is crime stories, very dark, moody, and noir is the French word for black. So it's black and white. There's a lot of black on the screen. It's kind of where that comes from, right?
Yes.
My question is, this one seems a bit unusual because typically when I think of film noir, it's things like Maltese Falcon or The Big Sleep, where you have like a detective or someone who's like a police figure is sort of the main character. That's not the case here. So I didn't know if that was really unusual or if that's if film noir is just bigger than my understanding of it. Was that an unusual thing to your knowledge about this movie?
Well, you have to keep in mind that the term for these films didn't exist when they were being made.
Yes.
They weren't working within tropes as they were making them.
Something we've constructed later to explain them. Interesting.
To explain the movement. And with that said, the Fred McMurray character, which we'll explain in a second, does act in a similar position that a detective or police officer might.
Yeah, that's true.
And we also do have a another character who works with Fred McMurray, played by Edward G. Robinson, who is actively acting as a detective throughout the entire story. Yeah. So the placeholder for that character still exists. But there are plenty of noir films that are categorized within the category that go outside of that detective convention. And there's even a few, one of which is called Lever to Heaven, which are in color.
Oh,
so,
interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know, like a modern film that's sort of playing with the genre is Rian Johnson's Brick, which is like a high school story, but it's like noir in that it's slow and moody and all of that, even though it's also in color. So that was, I was just learning about that because I'd seen that movie before. I really knew what film noir was, but anyway, that's a good movie too.
Yes.
But yeah, and so Fred McMurray too surprised me because he as the lead character is the criminal. And I was expecting, our lead to be trying to figure things out. But yeah, so I guess let's talk
about... That is a spoiler, by the way. You're going to know that pretty quick.
Yes, that's true. You find that out from the very beginning. So a little bit of the plot is that Fred McMurray is an insurance man, salesman. Mm-hmm. And we learn a lot about insurance and how it worked in the 50s, which is interesting. But
40s.
Yes, 40s. Yes. Sorry. But he meets pretty early on Barbara Stanwyck. And they immediately start kind of flirting. She's a married woman, and
he's trying to sell insurance to her husband.
Correct.
Who she does not have a good relationship with.
Yes. He finds that out pretty quickly too. So he first shows up and meets her. He's gone and she's in a towel having just gotten out of the shower or something. So it's pretty sexy right at the beginning too, where like it sets up that the tension between them pretty quickly. And then, basically a plot to murder her husband and collect insurance, life insurance, accident insurance on his death, sort of schemes.
Which is
up. Yeah.
Where the title comes from. It's a double indemnity clause,
yes.
Which means that you get twice the payout in a freak accident, basically.
Yes. So they want to stage a freak accident. And meanwhile, you have his coworker, who you mentioned, who is Edward G. Robinson. His name is Barton Keyes. He is the investigator, basically, for a lot of these incidents, and he feels like something's fishy, and he's trying to figure it out. I should mention this actually opens
after the husband after the husband gets killed. So the movie is not building up to the husband and getting killed. That's like that's like the first big thing that happens,
and then it kind of goes from there.
And then after that happens, you got Edward G. Robinson trying to figure out why this, because they're the insurance company. They don't want to pay out all that money.
Yeah. And Fred McMurray playing both sides and the incredible tension that draws up. Really, I think Hitchcock came into my brain several times, like the way the tension is built in these really suspenseful scenes. But I should mention too, the construct of the movie is that we start with him driving through the streets crazy because he's been shot, and he gets to this recording tape recorder thing in Ray's office, and he is giving narration for the movie and confessing to the crime and saying, here's exactly what happened. And it starts like flashing back. So, from the beginning that something has gone wrong and to the point that he's confessing. And so you're always waiting for that to happen too. So I think just on that storytelling level, it's really strong and because it keeps you guessing, but also lets you in on certain pieces of it.
Yes.
So that's kind of how the movie plays out. Again, without spoiling the ending, because there's a lot of twists and turns at the end there.
And it has all the, you mentioned the narration, which is one of the big tropes of a film noir. Mm-hmm. It also has the femme fatale. Barbara Stanwyck plays Phyllis Dietrichson, who is the character, the wife we've been talking about this whole time. And
she's probably the best performer in this movie too, I should say.
She is genius in the movie. She did get nominated for the film. Didn't want to play the role. Barbara Stanwyck Barbara Stanwyck has a really great career. She comes on really strong in the early sound films, probably because she has a great voice, you know. Mm-hmm. And she got known for playing hard-boiled characters in the early 30s. She's in a movie I referenced a few weeks ago called Babyface, one of the great pre-code films. And she branched out and did some really great serious work, including a movie called Stella Dallas. And she was in a wonderful movie written by Billy Wilder called Ball of Fire, which this was Billy Wilder writing before he started directing. And she got nominated for that film. She's also in in one of the great Preston Sturges comedies, The Lady Eve. And then later on, she would transition to television and get an Emmy Award and for the TV show The Big Valley, which was a Western.
Oh, yeah.
She made a lot of Westerns in her career as well, which makes sense because she's kind of a tough broad.
Yeah.
And
a very tough character in this movie.
Yes. Did not usually play evil people in any way. Yeah. She's in a great Christmas movie called Christmas in Connecticut. She was in the miniseries The Thornbirds, which was one of the great, you know, 80s miniseries when that was a huge thing. Mm-hmm. So she had a career that lasted almost up until her death, and she continued knocking out great performances all the way through.
Yeah, she has IMDb credits all the way till 1986.
Yes, and she didn't win an Academy Award, but she did get an honorary award. She was also married to Robert Taylor, who was a big leading man at MGM for 12 or 13 years. There are a lot of rumors that that marriage was constructed to cover up Barbara Stanwyck's sexuality.
Interesting.
But that is unsubstantiated, and I cannot make any comments. Those have all been rumors after the fact, so I can't.
I have a lot of things to Google now and
yes.
dig into this conspiracy because that's fascinating.
Really quickly, but she is a great actress, and she made a lot of really great movies. So
I was going to ask, Babyface is the one you mentioned before, where she's like sleeping her way up the corporate ladder, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So she has quite a career, and she's really great in this. Yeah, as I mentioned, really tough, but also, from the beginning, she's in on this conspiracy, and then, not a very honorable character, perhaps. Neither of the leads are here.
No, we do not have good guys leading this one.
Yeah.
Which is part of the thing I think that makes it so fascinating is you're cheering on a crime through the first part of the movie. You're cheering on them murdering this man, and the scene where he is killed, the husband is killed, which is done in a close up on Barbara Stanwyck's face.
Yes.
Barbara Stanwyck is not actually participating in the killing itself.
But she's feet away. Yeah.
She is feet away, and you're just on her face while it happens. It's one of the most chilling things.
Yeah, I wrote that in my notes, like, oh my gosh, this is like the moment of the movie, because her performance is fantastic in that moment.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really great.
So dark. It's so dark.
It really is. I was shocked at how dark it is there, and then continues to get even more so.
You know, we talked last week a lot about the dialogue in All About Eve. This is another, any movie with Billy Wilder directing and writing is going to have great dialogue. But whenever you first meet them and he's doing his sales pitch, there's this really great sequence of lines where they're flirting, basically. Mm-hmm. And he says something like, "How fast was I going?"
Yes.
And
she says
something like, "There's a speed limit in this state, in this state, 45 miles per hour. How fast was I going? like she says like 70,
yeah,
say about 90, and he's like, why don't you step off your motorcycle and give me a ticket? And then like,
yeah,
it just keeps going, and you're like, I think I need to take a shower.
Yeah.
Like, why?
Yeah, it's
is
wild.
This dialogue so sexy?
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head in your shoulder.
In an evil way, it's like the most evil, sexy dialogue you've ever heard.
Dark and sexy. And I didn't expect, I mean, again, still learning about this time period, but I haven't seen that many things with, I guess, like an anti-hero in the way this has, like, you're cheering on these people, and it's almost a question of at what point do you stop rooting for the bad things they're doing? And it's probably different for everyone, but that's an interesting thing.
And keep in mind, we're in a period, because of the production code, there is a very, very clear rule in the production code where you can't get away with crime. Your characters have to pay the price. And so
consequences, I mean, in a way, must come in.
In the way that does take the air out of the suspense, I guess, if you know that going from the start. But but you also know from the start that something bad has happened to Fred McMurray's character. You know, Fred McMurray also had a pretty lengthy career, but I feel like most people, if they know him, they may know him from his TV show My Three Sons, which was on TV Land when I was growing up. It lasted for, it was like a TV show that lasted like 12 years in the 60s. So obviously it wasn't just the 60s if it lasted 12 years, but
till 72 it looks like.
I think it was and he was like apparently really difficult with the shooting of that TV show. He required, he was the star, the lead, but he had to have all of his scenes shot in one day, and so they spent one day just shooting shots with him, and then they would shoot the rest of the scene that he was also in without him.
That's
in the ensuing days. But he, you know, he was a movie star, so he could get away with it. But he also, he's also in The Apartment.
Yes, I just realized that. Film. Yeah, he's one of the shady business guys.
He plays a bad guy. It's funny because he didn't usually play a bad guy in films. It just happens that we think about that. But he was also in The Absent-Minded Professor, a Disney film.
Yeah, I was just seeing that. It's weird to see him smiling on the poster. Like, I know. He was happy in that.
And The Caine Mutiny is a great is a great little movie. He was in The Absent-Minded Professor, of course, becomes... it's the basis, or it was remade as a Flubber.
Flubber, yeah. So Son of Flubber was a sequel to that original.
Yeah, and then Robin Williams was in the movie Flubber in the 90s, remember, which was a remake, he had a pretty extensive career, and he actually made other movies with Barbara Stanwyck that were like romantic comedies.
Interesting.
So
yeah, they certainly have chemistry. That's really interesting.
They do. They do. A romantic comedy seems like a leap watching this movie, but
absolutely, especially like, so you mentioned like feeling like you need to take a shower, like the way it ends, which I won't spoil, but so you know something's going to go wrong, but just like how dark and how twisty is this going to get? And it's pretty rough at the end there. Like, oh my gosh.
It gets as dark and twisted as it can get. It takes you all the way to the edge. And gosh, Barbara Stanwyck is such a good femme fatale in this movie. You never are 100% sure what's going on in her head. And there's so many images of her in this movie that come to mind. She wears this kind of like not great wig the whole movie, and yet it kind of works in a weird way. She has these like heart sunglasses that she wears in a grocery store in this one scene.
She takes them off at a kind of intense moment.
Yeah.
Listen to me, bucko, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many. Yeah, there's so many great little. It's just a really, really great film, and it's a great example of, I mean, all of the people involved at the peak of their career. Edward G. Robinson was pretty famous for playing gangsters in the 30s. He's in Little Caesar is his big one. He has a line, is this the end of Rico? And so he was just known for playing those guys, you know, those hard-boiled bad guys.
Yeah, he has kind of a gangster-looking face.
He does. Yeah. Sounds like one, too. But so this is a very, this was a departure for him. And it was the first time he had ever been in a movie and not been the main character. He gets a pretty high billing in the film, above the title billing, even though he is the third person in the roster. And so he was a big star, and he was known for playing those types of roles, but him playing ultimately the good guy in the story was a little bit different. At the time
that he's significantly shorter than Fred McMurray, which is just kind of interesting too, that he's like, he almost seems Weasley when you first meet him. I'm like, what's, I don't know about this guy. And then he ends up being the force for good. And again, I think it's a question of like, when do you start rooting for the good guys on this? And maybe you don't, but it's interesting that it plays with that kind of idea. Let's talk about Billy Wilder a little bit. And then I have just a few thoughts on like interesting connections to some of his other movies that I've seen. But he's a pretty big name in that period, right?
Huge. Yeah. And he, you know, he's one of the most awarded, one of the most awarded writer-directors of all time. He won Best Director for The Lost Weekend. He also won for The Apartment. And I'm trying to think. I think he won for a third movie.
He won for The Apartment. He won for... Oh, he won director for Some Like It Hot. Yeah.
Yes. And...
And Sabrina. Or he's nominated. He was nominated for Sabrina, but did not win.
He also did win Best Writing for Sunset Boulevard, because two categories. The adapted went to Mankiewicz, and the story and the original story went to
For All About Eve. I gotcha.
For Sunset Boulevard, because you know there's two writing categories. So yeah, he also wrote though a lot of great movies even before he started directing, and he did like really fun comedy called Ninotchka. He did Ball of Fire, which I mentioned a little bit earlier. When he was given the opportunity to direct, he actually chose a very non-Billy Wilder film, or what we would not think of as a Billy Wilder film, called The Major and the Minor, which is a Ginger Rogers comedy, which I'm just going to read the IMDb description here so you can get an idea of what this is like. A woman disguises herself as a child to save on train fare and is taken in charge by an army man who doesn't notice the truth.
That's bizarre.
It is, and it's actually quite funny. I've seen it. You never at any point buy that Ginger Rogers is really 12 years old. But considering she's like 30 or older in the movie, but... it borders on creepy at times. It's really a strange film, but that movie was a very commercial film. And so he knew by making this Ginger Rogers comedy to kick things off, he would, you know, make a movie that had that would make a lot of money, and he would be able to do what he wanted to after that. And then he bridged into Double Indemnity not long after that, and he did The Lost Weekend, which was a huge, huge hit. He did a movie called A Foreign Affair, which actually shot in the ruins of Berlin.
Oh, wow.
With Jean Arthur and Marlene Dietrich. And then he went into Sunset Boulevard and Ace in the Hole. He's in a great, he did a great movie called Stalag 17, which is William Holden. And it's about this... prisoner of well, again, I'll defer to IMDb. When two escaping American World War II prisoners are killed, their German POW camp barracks marketeer J.J. Sefton, that's William Holden, is suspected of being an informer. So it takes place in a prisoner of war camp during World War II. It's amazing. 7 Year Itch, great Marilyn Monroe film. And he did a wonderful Audrey Hepburn movie called Love in the Afternoon, Some Like It Hot, The Apartment, you know, just on and on and on. He makes these movies in the 60s and in the 50s and 60s that it's just like hit after hit after hit after hit. And it slows down a little bit after that. But all of that, you know, is, and before he did any of that, he, of course, was already making some really great, he was also already writing some really amazing movies. But he was an immigrant, you know, he wasn't born here in America. He was born, I'm seeing where he's born because he moved around.
He was Hungary, maybe is where I'm seeing, but it has like a few different places listed as his birth area.
Yes, he was an Austrian born American filmmaker. So he made movies in America, but he was born in Austria. So he was an immigrant on top of all of that, which is just a beautiful story, and lived to be 95. So
yeah, that's really interesting. So my impression of him generally just that he's kind of I don't know, feels modern or sort of ahead of his time in a way. Thinking about like the gender dynamics of Some Like It Hot, which it's just poking fun at gender construct basically. And I think has some interesting, like it's pretty, for some people even today would be kind of too racy or too offensive, I think. So I think that's an interesting thing because it came out in 1959. It's a very funny movie and I really like that one. But then The Apartment as well, I think, empathized with the female characters more than anything else I'd seen from this era, I think.
He makes it's funny, you know, I'm thinking, here's a person whose English was not his first language, and he writes such amazing English screenplays. He moved, he moved here because of the Nazi Party rising in Berlin and then Paris, and then he moved. He was in Paris briefly, and then he moved out here. He then constructs some really interesting female characters in a time when you might not expect that, you know? And even commenting on aging in the way that he does in Sunset Boulevard. He also has Sunset Boulevard. You don't think about this, but Sunset Boulevard also has a great secondary female character. The girlfriend character who is an independent writer, career woman. And then you have this movie where you have this diabolical woman. I don't know what that says about his, it doesn't support him having great female characters quite as well much. But you're right, he does have
she's strong in her own way, I think.
She is. And the stepdaughter is very virtuous.
And in The Apartment, Shirley MacLaine, I think her character, it just shows like the ways that women are used and abused in Wall Street specifically, and the actual effect that that has on people, because you usually just hear the man's side of that story, you know? That was really striking to me at that. Anytime I've seen a few things by one director, I have to try to find any kind of parallels. I think with The Apartment, one of the things I remember from that is just like the sense of like almost loneliness of like the corporate world, basically. And actually, I had been recently watching the show Mad Men when I first saw The Apartment. And there's a ton of, it's a very similar time period.
Like very time period that similar.
It's depicting is like the time period was actually made. Like the office structure is the same, and a lot of similar themes there. And I think if you think about Don Draper, he is very similar to Fred McMurray in this film. He's a bit of an anti-hero, I guess, that you aren't sure that you're always on board with him, but you are fascinated and sort of want him to succeed despite yourself. And that was
kind of interesting. That's a really good comparison. Fred McMurray is so great at that. It's like when praising Barbara Stanwyck, let's not neglect Fred McMurray. Yeah. He does a really great job playing this character, right down to the way he narrates, the way he talks.
Yeah.
It's so perfect for the entire mood of the film. It's so hard to talk about great movies sometimes because just like it's perfect. Go watch it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this whole thing, we haven't really said anything negative about any of the movies we've been talking about. It's because they're some of the best ever made. So they're so, so good. One other just interesting comparison with Sunset Boulevard is the narrator construct. And so in this one, in Double Indemnity, you know from the beginning that something's gone wrong and he's confessing and there's recording and that's how you're experiencing the story. In Sunset Boulevard, similarly, you see the narrator die at the beginning. Like, he gets shot in the back and falls in the pool, like the very opening of the movie. And then it's his thoughts or something telling, and you're like, is he alive? Like, what's going on? You don't really know. He's narrating it. So similarly, like doomed narrators, which really adds an interesting layer, I think, to the story in both of those. So
yeah, for sure. And interestingly, this is the second movie in a row that we've talked about that has narration.
Yeah.
And, you know, Billy Wilder and Joseph Mankiewicz are paralleled in some ways because they had big movies come out in 1950, which were competing against each other. But both of those films and both of their films in general, you have narration playing a huge part. And that's a big thing with some of these Billy Wilder films. Because both this and Sunset Boulevard and not Some Like It Hot or The Apartment, but he did kind of perfect this often seen device that's used in so many 1940s film noirs. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, that is Double Indemnity. Definitely, definitely worth watching. Rentable online. I had to find it from the library here to get it for free, but it is very, very good and definitely worth watching. That is all for this episode. I wanted to mention really quickly, though, Rance has other podcast things he's doing, and one is The Envelope Please, which I finally listened to, and it's so good. I am like,
oh, thank
addicted
you
addicted to it. It's going through Oscar history, and it's just the right amount of educational and funny, and they're talking through not just the movies that won Best Picture, but and that on its own is really interesting, but also the movie year and what was happening with the Academy historically. So I can't speak highly enough of that. Go listen to The Envelope, Please. It's a very, very good podcast.
Please do. I would appreciate the downloads, rates, subscribes, all those things.
Yes, all of that.
We're up to, I think, this, let's see.
Yeah, so this, I listened to It Happened One Night because we had recently discussed that movie. And so I was like, I want to hear more about that. But then I loved it so much that I went back to the beginning and I'm listening through.
Yeah, I think that we are about to do You Can't Take It With You. So we'll be up to 1938.
All right.
I had to think about it because we recorded ahead. We anticipated that we might have problems keeping up if we did this weekly. So we got way ahead first.
That's a good idea.
We're watching every single winner of the Best Picture Academy Award and trying to give context. Because the thing about the Academy that I feel like should be mentioned is that there are reasons beyond the movies why something wins Best Picture. And so it's interesting to look back and see, okay, what was a huge hit with audiences that year?
Mm-hmm.
What was something that kind of went under the radar? What was the critical hit? What was the audience hit? What was what was going on in the world at the time that might have influenced people's taste? You know, and because oftentimes something wins Best Picture and you kind of think like, huh? Because you see,
haven't heard of that one, but I have heard.
Yeah. But then you see another movie was nominated or another movie wasn't even nominated. And you're like, this is clearly the best movie of this year. Mm-hmm. You know, like we've been talking a lot about The Apartment. You would think that The Apartment's number one rival in 1960 would be Psycho. But Psycho wasn't even nominated.
Wow.
You know, and so you have to think about, okay, well, why wouldn't Psycho be nominated when it's so clearly better than The Alamo, directed by John Wayne?
Which one?
which got a nomination, the apartment won.
Oh,
the apartment winning is fine.
Yes, yes.
Although I would I personally, between Psycho and the apartment.
Yeah, that's a tough call.
But
I think I go the apartment, but I love Psycho too.
But you also have to think about like what the Academy thinks about horror movies, right, and and what the Academy thinks about comedies, and what and all those other qualities that go into it. Double Indemnity was nominated for Best Picture.
I just realized we haven't talked about what it was nominated for. It didn't actually win any, but it was nominated for a picture, for actress in leading role for Barbara Stanwyck, director, screenplay, and cinematography, sound, and music.
Yes, all of which are wonderful.
Yeah.
The
cinematography,
yeah, cinematography
great.
Is,
yeah, there's
is incredible.
Great use of shadow and stuff in several scenes.
Yeah. But, you know, 1944, the movie that wins, I think most people objectively would say is not nearly as good a movie as Double Indemnity. It's Going My Way. Going My Way was a uplifting story that took place during World War II.
Yeah, in World War II here, yeah.
Very much was the type of film that during World War II was going to win Best Picture.
It's a Bing Crosby movie, yeah.
Which sets us up very nicely for next week for another Best Picture winner. A movie called The Best Years of Our Lives is what we're talking about next. And that film is a great film, but also could not be better. I mean, is very much positioned in a place where its win and its success at the box office makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. Well, I can't wait to watch that and dig into that. That will be for next time, but I guess we can go ahead and wrap up. Thanks again, Rance. This has been such a fascinating dig into Double Indemnity. This might be, it's hard to say, this might be my favorite. I love Billy Wilder of the ones we've talked about. I love Billy Wilder, and I don't know, I like these dark, twisty tales. That was really, really good. So
well, this next movie is not dark and twisty, just so you know.
It's a change of pace.
It's different. It's dark in places, but not twisty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there you go. That's Double Indemnity. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time. Thanks, Rance.
You're welcome.
And that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks again to Rance for being such a big part of this series. If you want to support the show, leave a rating or review on the podcast, or buy some Art House Garage merch from our website. If you want to keep up with the latest Art House Garage podcasts, videos, reviews, etc., check out our website at arthousegarage.com or follow on social media on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Follow at Arthouse Garage. You can sign up for the email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, and feel free to email me with any comments, questions, or concerns, andrew@arthousegarage.com. I hope you'll come back for the next episode in this series on the movie The Best Years of Our Lives, and until then, keep it snob free.